This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. For the second time this month, a Cincinnati police officer used his gun while responding to a call. The latest incident happened in East Price Hill. We begin the Friday news review with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome back, Sharon.
Good to see you.
And WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us. You can email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and get some of those into the show as well. So, Bill, what happened in East Price Hill this week?
Well, Tuesday afternoon, about 3:30, police got a 911 call from a woman who said she was in the 300 block of Crestline and she had just had a fight with a friend and was ready to do harm to herself. A few minutes later, police got a call from another place in the 300 block of Crestline from another woman who said the first woman had a knife and was trying to get into her home. Two officers were dispatched to the scene. They got there. They found the woman. I believe she was 23 years old. She was on the front porch pacing back and forth with a knife. They showed the body cam footage. One officer came up and tried to de-escalate the situation, said, hey, put the knife down. She would answer, but it was not audible on the body cam footage. He said, hey, let's start over. What's your name? What's going on? At that point, the woman who was inside the house opened the door. She looked out the window, saw the officers, didn't realize the woman with the knife was still there. She opened the door. The woman with the knife tried to get in. Officer tried to tase her. The taser did not take effect. One of the barbs didn't hit her. The other officer used his service weapon, fired once, hit her in the leg. She eventually went down to the ground. They got her out. They cuffed her. They put a tourniquet on her leg to stop the bleeding, and that was apparently the end of the story. This woman is known to Cincinnati police. She has had some mental health issues in the past. This was another mental health crisis. That's why I'm staying away from using her name. And this week, Chief Isaac said, look, we deal with a lot of mental health crises out on the streets. Our officers are trained to handle this, but we can't do it alone. This is not something that the police department owns. We can't do it just by ourselves. We need more cooperation from other sections of the community.
But what are city leaders and the police chief saying about the way the incident was handled? Does it look like everything was okay?
Prosecutor Joe Dieters is not going to press charges against the officers. He said they acted heroically because inside the house, besides the woman, there was a senior citizen and five very young children. The idea is that had the woman with the knife gotten in, she may have created a hostage situation. And the chief prosecutor are both saying officers acted appropriately and within their training guidelines.
It highlights why the body cameras are so important, because in both of the incidents, because the other one was in Madisonville, you're able to see what happened. And in this one, there was a lot of de-escalation first, where they tried to, you know, really calm her down and used all the tactics that they're supposed to. The other scene unfolded much more quickly, but in both cases, you saw, you know, what the officer was seeing and having to do.
Are there any plans to facilitate cooperation or further growth between the Cincinnati Police Department and the mental health agencies, have we heard?
Chief Isaac says, you know, it's something he talks about with the staff every day. You know, there's only so much the police department can do. Other agencies have to step up and say, hey, let's work together. And if those conversations are going on or ongoing, I haven't been invited, so.
But this was the second police-involved shooting
in one month. Yes.
Okay, what was the previous event?
July 4th, a man called 911 and said there was a guy at Bramble Park in Madisonville who was acting erratically, carrying a knife. Turns out it was the guy who had the knife who called 911. Two officers arrived. He walked rapidly toward them, brandishing the knife. This is once again illustrated on the body cam footage. One officer got off to his flank. The other one, the primary officer, backed up, drew his weapon, said, hey, stop, drop the knife, stop what you're doing. And this officer kept backing up as he did until he felt he could not back up anymore and fired two rounds.
And that person survived as well?
I believe, yes, he did.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to follow those reports as well. An issue facing the Cincinnati Police Department also is apparently a lack of officers, according to Police Chief Elliot Isaac. What do we know about this currently?
You know, this conversation began unfolding last week after, you know, we had since 2000, a record number of homicides in June. It was pretty, you know, we had a very scary June, and everyone's really trying to get a handle on what had happened, and counsel decided that they wanted to talk about this and really help and, you know, give the police department resources. And you saw PG Sittenfeld come out with like a big, you know, a comprehensive plan last week. It involves, you know, better lighting and high crime spots and opening the rec centers later and more like holistic looking things that can help the police officers. And then I had a chance to interview the chief on Monday, and he was very grateful that council was taking this seriously and all the help that he could get, he definitely wanted. And he said as clearly as he possibly could, the number one thing I need is more officers. He's like, all of these things help. I need these things, and we need to address the root cause. He's like, but in the meantime, I need the manpower to put guys on the streets.
So what happened at City Hall this week in regards to this? Was there some legislation considered?
Well, they were supposed to look at PG Sittenfeld's motion. They met yesterday in a special council meeting. They're on break. They did gather to do things. It ended up being a motion. It's going to have to go through budget committee to really get those things all done, put some costs to them, which is always, you know, that's how City Hall is. Like, ideas, they cost money. And then that's where the discussion kind of starts there. But during that discussion, they very seriously said, we understand, Chief, and we want to give you those officers. And that the meeting kind of took that turn. It's not as easy as saying that, though, just like the other things. It costs money. But I do think that conversation's really gathered steam, and it could, you know, it could happen this time.
What are they saying is causing the shortage of officers in the department? Because they are authorized to have a certain number, and they're just currently not at that number, as I understand it.
Well, we're at a period where there's a high number of retirements. If you think about, like, going back to the 80s and 90s, that's when the police department really, they were in this big hiring spree and expanding with 80, 90 officers every year added to recruit classes, and that kind of kept happening. So if you look where we are right now, it's, you know, 30 years later, 25 years later, these officers want to retire. And, you know, in past years, they might have stayed some. But the retirement system, how it works now, it actually behooves them, you know, monetarily to retire when they're supposed to retire. And policing's a very difficult job right now. And, you know, I think people's loved ones, and they're like, when it's time to retire, it's time to retire.
And they only need to put in about 20 years before they're eligible for retirement.
Correct. Or, you know, of course, the longer you go, the more money.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So Councilwoman Tamaya Dennard issued a statement about what was considered at City Hall this week, and she's kind of taken a different approach, that perhaps more police officers aren't necessarily the action. I'll read a little bit about what she says. Quote, if we're going to save lives and move the needle on gun violence, we will have to address the root causes. We can't arrest away our problem. We already spend 2/3 of our city budget on police and fire. Yes, we need them, but research has proven that increased police complement doesn't reduce crime. So she says that she'll bring forth and fund ideas brought to us by the people who are closest to the pain. They are also subject matter experts. So I guess we don't know exactly what her plan might be, but she looks to be intending to present an alternative to answering this problem of this little crime spike that we're experiencing and also the challenges that the department are facing in an alternative way to just adding more force.
Well, certainly. We have a very high level of poverty here. And David Mann echoed what she was saying. He didn't say we didn't need the officers, but he really talked about getting at these root causes. And that's been a hallmark of this council. They really want to do things like eviction prevention and address poverty. That's a slower engine. It's very expensive to do where you can actually move the needle. I'm hopeful these next 2 years with this council, what they're going to do. I'm interested in watching how they address this affordable housing. But, you know, in the meantime, if you look at what she's saying, these people are subject experts, and you can't really argue with them. But then you want to look at the chief and be like, well, he's the police chief. He is 30 years in. You know, before he became the chief, there was a lot of politics surrounding all of this. But this is a very well-respected officer whose, you know, time came after, you know, the civil unrest. He spent, you know, a very long time on the streets working on the collaborative agreement. He understands problem-solving policing. So I think, you know, all of these things on the table, you know, they just have to find the money for all of them.
Yeah. Are there other alternatives outside of that eviction prevention? What else are we hearing as possible areas to explore, if anything, yet?
You know, this affordable housing thing, I think, is going to be the biggest deal. You can't have people, Mark Carnute at, you know, the Inquirer, he just had like a huge story last Sunday about a family that bumped around to four different homes.
Yeah, we had him on the show.
Just in the year that he followed them. And like that is, it's such instability. And so those are the things you don't want for your children. And I went to the rec center. I think we're going to be talking about that coming up and saw these children and what their days are like. And like, you have to provide stability and get to these things earlier.
In January, Cincinnati Edition hosted a show about police hiring trends. And it was reported by us, WVXU, at that time that according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, there are approximately 700,000 full-time officers working today. And that number is down about 23,000 from just 2013. And the ratio of officers to residents also down from 2.42 officers for every 1,000 residents in 1997 to 2.1 officers for every 1,000 residents today. So this does seem to be an issue nationally that there are just fewer officers available.
Well, I mean, the chief also mentioned in my conversation with him that, you know, didn't really get discussed publicly, that it's hard to find officers in today's. They have to be a lot of things. You know, they're looking for educated men and women who can deal with mental health crisis. I mean, they're asked to be a lot of things. And possibly, you know, people are looking at the career not like they used to for the difficult job that it really is. And instead of just this idealistic, like, oh, this is a hero job. It's a very difficult job. So they have to find the right people with the right mentality, especially in Cincinnati, looking at the collaborative agreement. And so it's also hard to find officers.
And policing is expensive for municipal governments. Public safety tends to be one of the higher areas of the city's expenses. What I'm noticing in Northern Kentucky governments, in their many police departments that they have on the south side of the river, is that the police departments are putting out calls for lateral moves. So they're trying to find recruits who aren't new. Perhaps they've retired from another department and that won't require a pension contribution from the new department that's hiring them, or somebody that doesn't have to be funded to go away to the basic academy so that, you know, you don't lose them for 2 months while they're training and then you get them down the road. I'm wondering if there's any discussion about that type of hire in Cincinnati.
The chief said he prefers to start fresh with all the things that a Cincinnati police officer has to do, but certainly a lateral class is something that can be brought on much quicker because they have the training already. And also a lateral class might be more expensive because you have to tell somebody from where they're coming from that, you know, being a police officer in a city where you're going to go call to call, you're going to go to police, two police involved shootings in 1 month. You might have to go to Fountain Square for a mass shooting. It might be a more difficult job than other departments. So the lateral class might not be as easy on the side of the river.
The Friday News Review will continue in a moment. First, we've got to say goodbye to Bill Reinhardt. He's got to go prepare for All Things Considered this afternoon, keeping an eye out for all the debris that might be in the roadway. Can't wait to find out what that might be this
afternoon.
That's
always my favorite part.
Thanks for being here today, Bill.
Thank you.
Sherry is sticking around, and up next, we'll talk about the latest design of FC Cincinnati's soccer stadium here in the West End, what the team's leadership says about it, and what we know about its potential impact on sound again at Music Hall, and later, the story behind the rise and fall of everything but the house as the company looks to rebound. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium has a new look. What does that mean for the West End? And what does it mean for the sound at Music Hall? The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sherry Coolidge. Thanks for sticking around, Sherry. And now we're also joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Join us, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Okay, it's been a while since we've had Soccer Talk edition of the Friday News Review.
interview, so I'm excited about this one. So we know there's
2 weeks.
It's been a long time. We used to talk about this almost every week, but we know there's been some concerns and lengthy debates over policy as it relates to this FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium and its location in the city's West End. But this updated design will, quote, reclaim vigor and glory for the West End, officials said, as quoted by WVXU's Ambriel Crutchfield. What's new with this design?
Well, I mean, it looked completely different to me than what we've seen before.
Well, it has a new architect.
And it has, yeah, right. It has a new architect.
And I went, so they unveiled the final design this week. Okay. On Tuesday, they had a huge press conference. They rolled it out with as much fanfare as you would think, you know, for a project of $250 million. And we spent a long time on Tuesday. You know, there was a panel discussion. There were, you know, renderings, videos. And so it does have a new lead designer, and it looks different, as you would think somebody new would do.
Why did they switch designers?
Well, that's a great question, but I don't actually know the answer to that. Maybe you do, Sherry. But it was earlier this year, and the new guy basically had to redesign it on the fly because demolition of the stuff that was where the stadium is going was already underway. So the new guy kind of came in, and he had to fit his design into the space that they had already kind of allocated.
He's from a company that's known for soccer specific stadiums. It's called Populous, and so as you know, these major league soccer teams come online with all these expansion teams. This company's really been designing bigger and better and prettier, and we're heading towards like European status probably. Yeah. And so he's from this company.
Okay. And so what specifically is different about this than the other renderings that we had seen previously?
Well, I mean, the old renderings, it kind of looked like they were landing in an orange spaceship in the middle of the West End. This new design is really streamlined is the word I would use for it. It's more kind of vertically oriented, I would guess. There's a term I'm trying to think of that they describe the exterior as, and I cannot recall off the top of my head. But you know, it's really kind of a stunning. It looks good. It looks way better than what we had seen previously, and you know, I think it's an improvement, and people seem to be pretty happy with it, at least early on.
It was supposed to be wrapped, and I mean, I never use the technical term because no one knows what that means, and I forget the name of it because I never use it. But it was like a glowing plastics material, and this is used in a Lawns Field in Minneapolis, which is not necessarily in a neighborhood that is like ours. And that stadium was unveiled earlier this year to great fanfare and beautiful and more like these European stadiums. And we were going to do something similar. But they think they wanted something different. And then they kind of scaled that back as the neighborhood was freaking out about what that was going to mean for light pollution. And Chris is going to talk about sound pollution, I think, in a minute. But this whole that's gone. So it had been scaled back, and now it's completely gone. And it's this motion. It's like a video board, and it's only on the one side. It doesn't face the West End neighborhood per se. And on it, it struck me as very graceful. It's like a swooping design that meets in the middle. And, you know, the architect was talking about how this represents, this is very architecture, you know, like the athletes, the graceful athlete and the two teams on the pitch. And it debuted to much greater fanfare, I think.
I found the term. There's 513 vertical fins. Fins is the word they've been calling kind of what the exterior is. It's hard to describe things on radio, isn't it? Boy, I'm sorry.
It makes me think of on 7th Street, the mural that lines with the different, the vertical lines, right? And it reminded me a little bit of that. Yeah. But this, of course, is going to be a lighted element. And you're really going to be able to see it from the hill, from the east, from over the Rhine. When we are on and they said, this is designed, we are on television at times broadcast to the entire world, because that's what soccer is these days. You're going to think, wow, this is Cincinnati. And what did they call it, Chris? Jewel.
Oh, yeah, the jewel. Well, there was the proverbial hyperbole there, like the jewel in the Queen City's crown or whatever. I mean, let's face it, we have a lot of great historic buildings. I'm not sure this quite rises to that, but it's a pretty good-looking building.
Well, one good-looking building that's also quite historic is Music Hall, and it's right here as well next to us. And an old story appears to be new again in a way. So we're concerned again about sound from the stadium and its potential impact on some of the arts organizations.
I don't think anyone ever really stopped worrying about it.
Right. I think they were kind of quiet about it. And we're not sure yet what the impact will be. From the team's perspective, they will tell you that they have more of the stadium covered. And the architect told us that it was designed to redirect the sound into the stadium. The music hall folks the member companies, we should be clear on that, the ballet, the opera, the symphony, the May Festival, I'm probably forgetting at least one of them, but they all speak as one voice now on this issue. And they're not quite yet sure whether it's going to be sufficient. At one point, they had said that both music hall and the stadium itself were going to need to be modified to contain the sound and prevent any of it from seeping into music hall during a performance. They haven't backed away from that, but they also haven't reiterated that it's the case. I think they're going to have to go. They've said they're going to have to go back to the firm that is consulting on this with them. It's called Acoustics, and have them take another look at the stadium and the new stadium design and determine what the impact is going to be.
There's already dueling studies. So, you know, the Cincinnati Arts Association representing all these groups has a study and says, you know, at a quiet moment during the performance, you might be able to hear a goal. Soccer, you know. A celebration of a goal. Yeah. But, you know, the team, they did their own and they said that is not true. So I think
there's a little self-interest, I think, in that former study, but so be it, you know.
Well, and maybe one day we'll end up with FC Cincinnati the Opera, then all of it will work out.
I do.
Be a good opera.
I think it's important to note that the music hall, you know, it does belong to the taxpayers in a way. There's a huge $10 million taxpayer investment in this building that was just redone to the tune of $60 million.
Right.
So what does the modification mean? I mean, do they give any indication of what that work looks like?
Not really all that specifically, but we know that the sound could seep in through the roof of music hall. That's where the problem is. It's an old, very old building and wasn't designed in a way to, you know, prevent that kind of noise from coming in potentially. So, I think the interesting question will be for Music Hall is, do they come and ask for the taxpayers' assistance in making whatever modification needs to be made to Music Hall to prevent this sound from coming in? Remember, Music Hall is owned by the city. Now it's managed and overseen by the Cincinnati Arts Association and the music hall member companies. But ultimately, it is a taxpayer asset. And I would not be surprised if there's an ask coming, you know, to city council. And so it would be very interesting to see how they react to that, if that is indeed what happens.
So before we switch gears, can we just talk about the FC Cincinnati team in general? Because I'm curious about, you know, this is a fan base that emerged very quickly and rapidly. You know, the fans love it. And Sherry, I know you're a fan of the team outside of reporting on stuff and the way it
evolves.
Less a
fan and more like osmosis that by covering the stadium, I've just had to learn all about soccer.
Sure, of course. Okay, so I'm wondering what the fans feel like now, because they're in Major League Soccer now. This is their first season. It's not going great. I mean, you know, you expect a team in its first year in the big league.
The team is in last place.
Yeah, they're in last place, and you kind of have some of these controversies around the stadium and all that. I'm just wondering, how do the fans feel this season? Do they feel like Cincinnati sports fans?
Well, I think there's certainly some of that, but they're much more hopeful. Honestly, they're still coming off of this winning USL. We won every game for months on end last year, and they keep each other in check. They're turning out in droves still. And even when we lose, if you look at the fan boards online, they don't want to hear the negativity. They are still all very positive about things. And I think there's definitely a realization that there's some USL player holdovers. And I think this is going to change as we head towards a new stadium and become, you know, couple years into actual Major League Soccer. Yeah, but they're a hopeful bunch.
You have to have a certain amount of patience when you jump a level.
Well, and if you live in Cincinnati, there's a certain amount of patience that's not different here.
Boy, we are known for our patience, aren't we? Okay, let's move on to the Hamilton County Commission. A law firm recently concluded an investigation of alleged harassment there. Chris, can you just give us the backstory? Like, who were the players and what were the accusations?
Yeah, basically the chief of staff for the new commissioner, Stephanie Sumro Dumas, basically accused commissioners Portune, Driehaus, and their two top aides, Victoria Parks and Alex Linzer, of basically racial harassment, that they had harassed him because of his race. He's an Indian American. Dr. Sohi is a pediatric dentist by trade, but he's also chief of staff for Commissioner Dumas. And the report came out, it actually was completed back at the end of March, and it basically kind of concluded, well, this is kind of a kind of workplace, you know, kind of workplace tension, workplace conflict that you would have in any workplace. One of the things that you really kind of got to get your brain around is that Dr. Sohi accused Victoria Parks, who's Portoon's chief of staff, of basically punching him. And the conclusion in the back of his shoulder, and the conclusion of the lawyer that the county hired for an internal human resources investigation, was that this was basically a simple tap on the shoulder to get his attention during a meeting of the commissioners. And so this conclusion, we understood that it was complete, and we got out through a public records request and wrote a story about it. Just in the last day, we got wind that Dr. Sohi had filed his own response. He maintains that, you know, for example, that the harassment did occur, that he did get punched in the shoulder by Victoria Parks. And it was really an interesting kind of response. It was kind of attributed to his lawyer, but it was really kind of written in kind of a strange, kind of broken English. You can read the quotes from it on our story at Cincinnati Business Courier. But so it's kind of continuing this kind of bizarre situation at the county, where there seems to be a lot of conflict between Commissioner Dumas's office and Commissioner Portoon.
Well,
and
Commissioner because
Driehaus's office, yeah.
In recent years, we've had commissions that are two Democrats and a Republican, and two Republicans and a Democrat, and yet behind the scenes there was always harmony. And, you know, very, you know, tempered, thoughtful conversations, not always the hallmark of what's going on in City Hall. The commission was always something different than that. And then to see, of course, Chris Monzel was defeated by Stephanie Dumas, and turning the commission all Democrats, and then you would think that everyone's going to roll along, and the first time ever that's three Democrats? Yeah. I don't know, or a long time anyway.
Probably since the Civil War, who knows, right?
Yes, I forget, it's something.
Yeah.
But to see that tension unfolded almost immediately that we would be hearing about, and then you did see, you know, this filing, it was shocking.
Yeah, so Stephanie Dumas is new and was sort of a surprising victor in that election over longtime incumbent Chris Monzel. Didn't do a whole lot of campaigning, but it looked like she benefited from the blue wave that's taking place in Hamilton County. And it's not been completely harmonious even with her as part of the commission, with all the Democrats working together. I'm wondering, what is the working relationship going to be like now that this investigation has concluded? Are people going to be able to get along?
Well, one thing to say there, that there's two investigations, really. So the county, all of what we're talking about stems from the county's human resources investigation. And this is because Dr. Sohi filed a complaint with the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. And so that state level investigation is continuing, and the results of that have not been announced. But I think things are pretty tense. The Inquirer, Scott Wortman, had a pretty good story where he looked at all the emails flowing back and forth between the commissioners, and I think there was kind of a pretty much a big lull after this point. What we've seen on the commission is a lot of 2-to-1 votes, where Commissioner Dumas has been the dissenting vote. So it's not all that different from when Commissioner Monzel was the only Republican. It seems like we're going to have a lot, you know, we have a lot of 2-to-1 votes on certain things.
If you're a pediatric dentist, why do you want to be chief of staff for a county commissioner?
I have no idea. I would love to talk to Dr. Sohi, but he has not returned any phone calls from me in the last, well, basically since we broke the story, we've called him a number of times.
Well, I wonder what the political future looks like for Commissioner Dumas then. Is this something that's going to hang around her neck a little bit, or she can't build any type of consensus or any type of base to carry her forward as she maybe runs for re-election or seeks another office someday?
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Democratic primary for her seat if she runs for re-election. Yeah. This is just a very unusual situation, and we're seeing that a lot. You know, in the sheriff's race next or in 2020, there's going to be a primary between two Democrats. That one's a little different, right? Because Jim Neal is perceived as a conservative, and his opponent is obviously kind of teaming up with the more progressive members of the party. This, I think, is more of a working relationship problem that could result in a primary.
And he has had a very high profile. I mean, think about, like, I mean, does who really knows the name Victoria Parks,
right?
She's a part of a staff and does, she's a very hard worker and respected, like, inside the county. But that's not, she's just not the public face of that office. But, you know, Dr. Sohai, he definitely is a very public face for her office.
He's run for office himself.
He's running
the guy with the signs up by the Kenwood exit.
He's got a lot
right?
of signs, right? Yeah. On his either current or former office there, he ran for state legislature at least once and maybe some other offices as well. Never got the Democratic nomination for those seats. I mean, for example, he ran for the seat that Bridget Kelly currently holds in the state house.
Have the other commissioners said anything about the results of the investigation?
Not publicly. No, there's the interesting thing in one of the reports that came out. So there's a kind of an overview of the charges that Dr. Sohi brought against the commissioners, but then there's a separate memo that the lawyer, whose name is Teresa Nelson, talked about. Basically, she talked about her interviews with people. And she concluded that, she reported that the people that she had interviewed said there were a lot of general conflicts and issues within the county commission and the work environment, and that, quote, and the conflicts and issues are often but not always instigated or caused by Dr. Sohi. So it actually quotes one of the commissioners anonymously saying that they felt that Dr. Sohi has not fulfilled the reasonable expectations of his role and is unwilling to accommodate the natural flow of an office. And so this is like a scheduling conflict. It doesn't say which commissioner it was. We only have two that it could be, probably, which is Commissioner Portune and Commissioner Driehaus. But basically, the issue is they tried to set up a weekly meeting with him. And this is common because the commissioners cannot speak to each other about county business outside of public session because there's only three of them.
Right.
So if two of them have,
with two.
Right. If two of them have a meeting about county business, it has to be a public meeting. So what they do is basically the chief of staff for one commissioner will get together with another commissioner and their chief of staff to kind of discuss issues before the meeting. And they basically couldn't ever get this set up with Dr. Sohi. And this was a regular procedure going back, you know, decades probably, when there was, you know, when divided control of the county commission.
All right, Sherry Coolidge, we've got to get you out of here to make way for another Coolidge who's coming in for our next segment. So we appreciate you coming in and talking to us again. And Chris Wedderk, a pleasure to have you here as well. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Everything But the House, the online seller of secondhand goods, was growing an empire right here in Cincinnati. It had dreams of being the next Amazon. Then top executives quit. Some layoffs followed. What happened? Joining us now is Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Michael.
Questions, comments, join us. 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Alex, this was a very in-depth and very good story that you did on this. I want to just start with,
thank you.
Give us the explanation of what Everything But the House is.
Everything But the House is a .com e-commerce website based here in Cincinnati. It's grown like a weed. It's moved its headquarters several times to grapple with its continuing growing size. But what it does basically is it's basically a consignment website. The company founders had their roots in the auction and estate business. Initially, they began to concentrate on, they focused on folks who had to move suddenly or had a death or were downsizing. And they initially had a niche where they were basically, hey, we're white glove, we'll take care of everything. You know, you have a house full of stuff, you don't want to itemize it and appraise everything and go through the hassle of putting everything on the, up for auction or on online. We'll do all that for you. We'll even sweep out your house. We will sell all your stuff but the house. That was the initial thing. Over time, the company's business model has sort of evolved to more of a consignment. So like 2/3 of its customers and items are people selling decidedly less stuff at a time. But That's it in a nutshell, basically.
It grew exponentially very quickly, a very
insanely
successful startup. And
insanely,
your profile of it, this lengthy profile that you wrote, explores it in the form of a rise and a fall. Because at one point, they had ballooned to 1,000 employees.
Yes.
Currently have about 400?
It's about 400 nationally, 200 locally.
Okay. So what happened? When did it blow up?
Well, basically, origins of the company, the precursor of the business is basically a couple of business partners who joined together. They're both one's running an estate and auction business. Another one is a collector, but tech savvy. There's disruption around the start of the millennium in the industry. Baby boomers are retiring like crazy. The market is flooded with selling items, but there are fewer buyers. So the actual live in-person business is sort of getting a little more difficult for operators. And it's harder to max out, you know, the sale for your clients if that's your business there. Jackie Denny is operating such a business, but she meets a very avid collector who jokes that he became a collector himself to support his habit. And you know, aficionados in this, you know, it's very they talk a little bit about it like that. He worked on the technical side. His day job was at UPS and then later at Children's Hospital. But he was tech savvy, and he said, "Listen, you're having some issues. Why don't we relaunch this on the web?" And so they joined up forces, had a very modest company. They had their first sales online ever in 2008 after joining forces the previous year. And basically they just focused on that initial niche. They got rave reviews, word of mouth, crazy. Their sales doubled every year for the first 3 years and then were still growing very rapidly. They're just operating this nice little shoebox kind of company here in Cincinnati, you know, with lots of attention. But the problem is it's growing very fast and it's getting harder and harder to operate. And this story was great because you really get a sense of what it's like to launch a business. And I have to take my hat off to my editors and my my publication for indulging all the reporting that went into the story.
It was a lot of reporting and a lot of personalities that are involved in this as well. And I thought that was really
curious. I really wanted to get the flavor of it because this is a story about a very fast evolving company. And at any rate, so that was really nice. But long story short, what happens is the founders in about 2012, so four and a half, five years in, they're working 100-hour weeks. They are exhausted. They love their company. They love their baby. They're starting to get overtures by people saying, "Hey, you should franchise this," and they're not really sure. And they run into this team of local investors who they were very impressed with. Andy Nielsen, his brother, Jonathan, and their business partner, they were in a real estate deal, and they concluded that, and they were looking for a new venture, and they were very impressed with him, and he was a very impressive Andy Nielsen was a very impressive fellow. People describe him; he is a consummate salesman. He got first he convinces the founders, "Hey, I will buy out a majority stake in your company, and I have a plan to grow this," and he did. And he takes a company that was essentially a $5 million enterprise, which is, you know, like running a single individual McDonald's restaurant or something like that. A good, solid, real business, but a small one. And he very rapidly grows the revenues to about 20 times that after convincing East Coast venture capitalists to invest about $85 million. And what he did was he set up several satellite locations in ultimately 27 cities. He was aiming for, I think, the top 50 or so metro areas. And then there was talk, they wouldn't specify, of international expansion. Revenues were starting to flirt with $100 million. And then, then the growing pains hit a new level, basically.
And people can read that article in the Inquirer. We've got a link at wvxu.org. In just about 30 seconds that we have left together, I noticed that your article touches on the cities and their goal of attracting these types of tech-savvy and tech-heavy companies, and you explore what Cincinnati's role in that pursuit is, and I'm wondering what you found.
Well, thanks for asking about that. You know, one of the fascinating parts of this story, and this is included in the story, is sort of the story behind the story, and that's the environment, the tech, the growing tech scene here in Cincinnati. You know, as you probably remember from a year and a half ago or so, there was quite a lot of madness about the second headquarters for Amazon. Every city in America was bidding for it, including us. We made a bid. We were politely turned down. But what's going on is the digital economy is growing four times as fast as the U.S. economy overall. So this is a growing necessary sector. But the reason Amazon was looking for a second site is because the coasts, the traditional strongholds of tech are very full, and they're competing with each other for the same talent. So there's sort of a reciprocal situation going on with the flyover states and the coasts. They need new sites and new workers, etc. So what the story sort of gets into toward the end is where are we in that? And the short answer is we've got a lot of big companies with serious industrial strength tech operations like Fifth Third, Kroger, and we've got a lot of small startups. But what was really interesting about everything but the house was this was a company that was emerging as one of those middle companies that's like a bridge, and once you have enough critical mass in that middle, you suddenly have momentum to become a tech employer, a destination, that sort of thing. And what, there's a wonderful little chart in the story that sort of shows the metric I focused on was the unicorns. There's been about 200 of those. That's a company that's valued at $1 billion. It's sort of a breakthrough for a startup, basically. It's one reaching that mass. And they're only beginning to start to be sprinkled in middle states.
Everything But the House, The Rise and Fall of It by Alex Coolidge can be read in the Cincinnati Inquirer. Great article. Highly recommend. We appreciate you coming in and breaking it down for us a little bit.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. Buildings owned by the city of Cincinnati may be reaching the end of their lifespan. A $57 million funding gap to maintain the buildings could balloon to $170 million in 5 years. What's going on? The Friday News Review continues now with WCPO reporter Paula Christian. Welcome, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what are some of these buildings that we're talking about? I saw that you wrote about a fire station, the municipal garage. Tell us about what's going on with them.
Well, a lot of these buildings were built 80 to 100 years ago, and they've been maintained, but they're reaching the end of their lifespan. I mean, they are, like, for example, the fire station in Madisonville that was built 100 years ago when firefighters used horse and buggy. Well, that's just not working for modern equipment and for firefighters these days.
It impacts some of the infrastructure that, in terms of vehicles, like the fleet that can be accommodated at these places.
The municipal garage was built in the 30s, and their floor can't support most of the heavy weight of modern vehicles. So dump trucks that come in for service actually have to be emptied before they can pull into the garage, or the floor is at risk of collapsing.
Okay, so how do they pass their own code inspections? I mean, this sounds like almost dangerous.
Well, I asked that question, and the city manager assured me that all city buildings were up to code, and I have no reason not to believe him. But in the city's own reports from 2015, they warned that the city was a bad homeowner nearing the level of a slumlord.
And some of the reporting that you had was that the city currently budgets $2 million.
For 88 buildings.
Per year to fix the 88 buildings. That includes the city building, City Hall.
Absolutely.
And that includes fire and police stations and its municipal garages. And there's 3,500 city employees at some of these other facilities outside of the city building that are all impacted by the quality of the buildings as they stand now.
Exactly. Well, to give you an example, the municipal garage, it's unair conditioned. It's 90 to 100 degrees in the summer. All of these mechanics are repairing city vehicles. It hasn't been updated in decades. The city does not have $30 to $40 million to replace it, and it doesn't even have the $1 million to replace its roof. The city doesn't have hardly anything to maintain any of these buildings.
And the thing that reporters like us hear a lot from government officials is kicking the can down the road. We don't want to kick the can down the road. And often it's because the longer you wait to address infrastructure, the more expensive it gets to address. And so they're projecting $175 million needed to repair all of this in just 5 years, ballooning from 62 to 170 in just 5 years.
Well, you're exactly right. The older the buildings get, the more expensive it is to maintain. The city also has it has all of these roadways and sidewalks and bridges and hillsides to maintain. And cost of labor, cost of materials is more expensive now than it was a couple of years ago. So it's getting less work done every year than it did in years past. So the problem is huge. There is no easy solution. The city barely is scraping by with the budget it has this year. Maybe it could come up with a couple hundred thousand dollars, but it can't touch the tens of millions of dollars it needs to replace and renovate these buildings.
So surely, Paula, there's a plan.
Well, you would think, but I have yet to hear it. I did reach out to all of City Council before I came on the show, and I said, would anyone like to weigh in on how you fix these buildings? So I did hear back from 2 council members out of 9. Now they are on break. So I heard back from PG Sittenfeld, and I had a phone call with Greg Landsman. Greg Landsman assured me that the presentations will happen in his committee when they come back from August break, and they are making it a priority. But, you know, it's funding. It's going to have a tax is in the future. Regardless.
And I thought there was one very curious piece in your reporting, and it was that this really stayed under the radar during those budget hearings that got a lot of attention over the past couple of months leading up to the vote on what was going to be in the budget. And, you know, people were concerned about certain roads or maybe certain community organizations getting their funding. But you didn't really hear anything about the condition of the municipal-owned buildings.
No, you never do. I've listened to 4 budget cycles. I have yet to hear, oh my gosh, our fire stations are in rough shape. We really need to replace them. And that's because it's citizens coming in to talk about the needs in their neighborhoods. And they probably don't know, just like I didn't know. I did not know the Madisonville Fire Station was built for horse and buggy. And, you know, the city employees, they're not going to come to the budget hearings and say, hey, what about us? So it is up to the city administration and the elected leaders to advocate for city employees.
Paula Christian from WCPO. You can read more about her story there. We've got a link at wvxu.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Paula, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks.